I want to add my own thanks to the law school, to the Law Review, and to Bob Langer and his colleagues at Wigan and Dana for the privilege of participating in this wonderful program. About a half century ago, Walter Adams, an economist and leading figure in the field of antitrust, attempted to characterize the government's experience over the first six decades of the Sherman Act in pursuing Section 2 cases. And Adams reviewed the course of experience, including notable landmarks such as American Tobacco and Standard Oil in New Jersey, and came up with the following assessment of government experience. He said, the government has won many a lawsuit, but lost many a cause. Adams' comment sought to capture what he thought to be frailties in the effort to formulate effective remedies and to implement them. And his main criticism of this experience was that, in many respects, the Achilles heel of the government Section 2 case had been a lack of attentiveness to the question of what do we do if we establish a violation. My focus in talking about remedies today is on the government monopolization case. Since 1890, there have been about 150 of these. And I'm going to try to extract a couple of specific examples to demonstrate problems associated with carrying out remedies for monopolization. And for the most part, I'm going to assume that a violation has been established. So I'm going to be focusing on the question of what does one do about this. I'm grateful for Bert and Rick and Bob for breaking the ice on basketball analogies, because I'm going to use one. The real reason that Judge Jackson took a recess in March and early April, of course, was to follow college basketball, not to handle other pressing matters, and I'm grateful for that. In many ways, the Section 2 case can be compared to the NCAA finals. It is a single elimination, two-round process to the championship. In many respects, the trial on liability issues is the semifinals. And it is into the semifinals, historically, that the government has poured all of its effort, quite naturally. If we don't win in the semifinals, we don't get to the finals. But there's been a great tendency to leave all of your game in the semifinals and simply to be glad to get to the finals. Well, the finals are remedy. And what Adams and other commentators have suggested is that the effort is poured into the semifinals and there is nothing left in the finals. And that when the government shows up to play in remedy, when the judge says, what do you want me to do about this, nobody's at home to offer a convincing vision of what should be done. Indeed, the problem I want to talk about today is that remedy is usually treated as an afterthought. We've heard about the United Shoe Machinery case today, and United Shoe Machinery is often held out as the singular example of the failure of the antitrust system to develop effective remedies. This came out of the famous litigation in the early 1950s brought by the Department of Justice that challenged USM's position as the preeminent manufacturer of shoe-making machines. If you look at the reflections of the decision-maker, Judge Wysansky, and his expert law clerk, Carl Kazin, who served as his clerk in the case, you get a different vision about what went wrong. Kazin, in his book on USM, characterizes the government's proposal on remedy as ill-conceived, half-baked, poorly thought through, and inadequate. That the government clearly didn't devote much effort to the question of what ought to be done and how, when they proposed to Judge Wysansky to split up this company, how it should be undertaken. Wysansky's opinion in the case itself is extremely informative, because Wysansky reacts to the notion that judges have simply, to put it bluntly, lacked guts when it comes to remedies, wimped out, to use Bert's phrase. Wysansky says, think of it from my perspective. I'm a single, unelected, life-tenured federal district judge, and I'm being asked to restructure a major enterprise, a restructuring that will have lots of influence spilling out into the decades, maybe a significant impact on economic growth in a specific sector. I'll do it, but you better give me confidence that what I'm about to do is going to be a good thing. Or I'm going to say, take two aspirin, see me in a few years. This failure to develop a well-conceived approach to remedies, I've seen firsthand myself. Worked with Bert at the FTC in the late 70s and early 1980s. One of my jobs in the office I worked in was to look at the remedial possibilities in a series of cases that the FTC was pursuing that would have, among other things, restructured the petroleum industry, restructured the breakfast cereal industry, and imposed mandatory trademark licensing in several other cases, including one involving Real Lemon. Part of our job as these cases came through the pipeline was to start looking at remedies. So I spent a lot of time going through the case records and the foundations that the FTC had established leading to these cases. And the basic content of the files was, we'll figure that out later. We'll get to that when we have to. Rather than the remedy being an organic, fundamental element of the development of the case from day one, such that you had a vision of where you were going from the moment the complaint entered the record, that notion simply wasn't pursued. And what has it meant in many cases? Courts have said, I don't have a convincing roadmap here. I don't know that the government's done its homework. And when I look at the prosecution on the Microsoft case, I feel ill at ease for this reason as well. Aside from the relatively minimalist statement of remedial intentions on day one in the case in May, we've seen nothing from the plaintiffs about what their remedial vision is. I understand strategically why you might do that. If you put the big cards on the table on day one, in a sense you raise the liability bar by causing the judge to look at the evidence through a different set of filters. If I'm a prosecutor and ask for capital punishment, the jurors and other relevant decision makers may look at the evidence in a different light than if I say, I only want imprisonment. That happens if you put your remedial cards on the table early. But the failure to force yourself to do that, I'm convinced, denies you the discipline and the drive to think through those issues sufficiently in advance. And I see that as a weakness of the current government case. But that wasn't done from day one. To talk about these in more detail, I want to focus on three specific issues. I want to talk a bit about the possibility that the filing of a lawsuit itself is a remedy, and I believe it is. Bert mentioned this. I want to talk about three specific paths for judicial intervention: divestiture, mandatory licensing of intellectual property, and conduct. And I want to finish by talking a bit about process-related concerns. Let me start with one type of remedy that I think tends to be overlooked, and that is that the filing of the lawsuit itself is a remedy. I'm convinced that the very fact that the litigation is in place genuinely changes the behavior of the industry participants. What does it do for the defendant? I think it does two things. One is that it inhibits the aggressive pursuit of business tactics that existed in the pre-complaint period, and it inhibits them in ways that give the competitors more breathing room. It also serves to distract, I think, internally, the company's focus from developing new products, from pursuing new strategies, and the distraction of the lawsuit itself tends to diminish the firm's ability to compete effectively in the market. Let me mention two examples. It is the accepted conventional wisdom in the antitrust world that IBM ruthlessly defeated just about every plaintiff that challenged it from the late 60s through the early 80s. That it ran the government into the ground. A young lawyer named David Boies, assisted by a relatively young economist, Frank Fisher, defending the prerogatives of a dominant firm to design products as it wanted, to price them as it wished, to market them as it liked, crushed the government over a 13-year period. And IBM defeated nearly all of the 45 or so private plaintiffs that launched suits against it. IBM had to write a couple of checks, none bigger than low eight figures, to get out of those cases, but it beat the daylights out of just about everyone else who took it on. In terms of tactics and strategy, probably the most successful single litigation defense effort by an antitrust defendant in the history of the Sherman Act. Did IBM win? You can make an argument that it won, but it lost. How did it lose? The effort to support the lawsuit took lots of IBM's best people away from their jobs. The effort to defeat the Department of Justice led IBM to think that its main business in life was to beat the government, not to beat its competitors. The dependency of the lawsuit caused IBM to pull its punches a bit, giving other folks a little bit more breathing room, deflecting its attention away from threats on the periphery, like a little company in Redmond that had an idea about operating systems that might be important later on. IBM missed lots of the big developments going on, I'm convinced in part because it was waging this two-front war with the Department of Justice and the private litigants. A second example from my own experience, this is a private lawsuit, but a major antitrust case from the late 70s and early 80s. Before I became simply a truth seeker purely in academia, I was a shameless advocate for a law firm, and as a shameless advocate, worked on a case involving McDonnell Douglas and Northrop. $2 billion on the table, not nearly as well known as this case, but it involved many of the same intellectual property misappropriation efforts. For 4 years, the company waged battle, and I noticed in working with McDonnell Douglas how much time of its best engineers, how much time of its best designers was spent supporting the lawsuit. In particular, I worked with the man who had been responsible for the software design for their extremely successful F-15 aircraft and had worked on the F-4 program, two of the most successful combat aircraft programs in the post-World War II era. For 4 years, he spent almost all of his time working on the lawsuit. He was not doing his job, and he and many others were distracted away from their main business. I am convinced that in a subtle, hidden, unquantifiable but real way, it sapped the company's vitality. And it is no accident that in later major combat aircraft competitions, it fell behind. And indeed, it's not the McDonnell Douglas Corporation now, it's the Boeing Corporation. This lawsuit got in the way. So one thing the lawsuit does by itself, I think, is turn the firm's attention away. And I notice that top Microsoft management says in many ways it's business as usual. That's brave talk, but I don't think it is. And every minute a software engineer or designer in Redmond spends time working on the lawsuit, that's a minute spent away from her job doing the kinds of things that sustain competitive vitality. The second thing the lawsuit does, because it's out there, is it makes your rivals bolder. Gives them encouragement that they can do things that they can't. I can't give you a rigorous proof for this, but I don't think that the AOL Sun Netscape Alliance would have materialized in the same way, in the same form, with the same timing, had it not been for the lawsuit. And because the lawsuit could easily go on another 2 years to 30 months, that's about enough time for those folks to get their act together. That's enough time to knit together these disparate organizations. The Netscape folks who thought they were physicists dealing with the mere plumbers, AOL, out on the East Coast, to put together their different organizations, work with Sun, develop a new competing platform. That may be the window they need to get on their feet and make that process a success. Again, not the result of formal judicial intervention, not the result of a judicial decree, simply from the fact that the lawsuit's out there. I think we tend, when we look at the history of Section 2 litigation, to overlook the fact that the mere fact that the lawsuit is out there has an influence on its own. Let me turn to the judicial forms of intervention themselves, and let me talk about the most dramatic, that is divestiture, and use a couple of examples. There are a number of prominent examples, Standard Oil of New Jersey, American Tobacco, AT&T. There have also been experience with statutorily mandated restructurings that were fairly broad-reaching in their significance, such as the Public Utility Holding Company Act experience from the 1930s and 1940s. What are some characteristics? Well, one thing that gives you some amount of confidence that these measures aren't necessarily the end of the universe is to look at the defendant's predictions in advance. Standard Oil of New Jersey, for example, in its presentation to the Supreme Court in its argument, said that several things would happen if the court implemented the divestiture decree. Loss of jobs, shareholders getting wiped out, innovation being retarded, and oh yes, it's the conceit of the modern age to think that high technology is so much different from the old smokestack pedestrian industries. Standard Oil of New Jersey at the turn of the century was the innovator of its time. It was the prototypical network industry of its time. Rockefeller created, in a sense, vertical integration, broad-based horizontal integration. He was an innovator in refinery design and operation. And part of Rockefeller's argument was, let's see, prices are going down, employment's going up, I'm developing all kinds of new products, including gasoline for these automobile kinds of things that are coming along. Why me? Why are you coming after me in this instance? And by the way, I face all kinds of competitive threats from firms like Gulf, Texaco, British Petroleum, Royal Dutch Shell. Why are you bothering me? Standards lawyers made these kinds of arguments to the Supreme Court. And by the way, it's a Supreme Court that believed in property rights, kind of like defendants, didn't trust government intervention a whole lot, listened to the parade of horribles and said, the district court gave you 30 days to carry out the divestiture, take 6 months. But that was as far as they went in relaxing the requirement. What does this tell us about prospects for future restructuring? Well, it turns out the shareholders did better. The value of Standard shares held at the time quadrupled over a three-year period. Employment went up. The catastrophes didn't take place. Indeed, many of the remnants of the Standard Trust secretly, like Standard of California, in the official company history said, how horrible, how delightful. No longer would they take orders from 26 Broadway in Manhattan, but in the future, they pulled out of their briefcases now the gavel of the chairman of the board, not regional vice president. That's something that many of them liked. Cautions in looking at this experience. In Standard, the divestiture involved taking standalone functional units that were linked together through organizational ties, but basically were organized as standalone functional units and spun them off. Second, the assembly basically had taken place through merger, not internal growth. Many of the remnants had developed through merger. So when the court directed divestiture, it took functional, self-standing bodies and basically set them off on their own. It did not disassemble integrated design teams. It didn't disassemble integrated units of employees who worked on common projects. It took self-sustaining, self-standing organizations and basically spun them off. And in the post-divestiture period, it allowed reintegration to take place. From 1911 through 1930, you see the reassembly of vertically integrated enterprises that create the basic elements of the petroleum industry in the 20th century. And that was allowed to permit the realization of efficiencies related to vertical integration. AT&T, some similar cautions. In AT&T, you had the realignment by reconstituting functionally independent units, the Bell operating companies, AT&T long lines. Yes, indeed, you had some messy problems associated with deciding where certain common assets and interfaces would go. But for the most part, you had organizational units that were accustomed to functioning as self-standing operations. Thus, the divestiture decree there did not involve, again, the disassembly of integrated design teams. And AT&T also was the creature of regulation. Its monopoly didn't emerge through an evolutionary process of competitive give and take. There were fewer fears that you were tampering with the natural outcome of a competitive process. And oh yes, the government had something to trade here. We'll relax the restrictions of the 1956 consent decree that keeps you out of computers and restricts other business activities of AT&T. And this is step one in getting out from underneath the long shadow of regulation, not simply by the FCC, but someday by the state PUCs as well. I simply want to suggest here that the kinds of divestiture solutions that have been suggested as possibilities in Microsoft, in some sense might draw comfort from the past experience, but when we look at the actual form of the realignment and reorganization, involve much trickier decisions about who goes where and how the new institutions would be created. A couple of words about licensing as a solution. We've had experiences with this, mandatory licensing of intellectual property. And the literature on the outcomes is decidedly mixed. Two examples, one involving AT&T and IBM in the mid-1950s with semiconductor technology, one involving Xerox in the mid-70s with plain paper photocopier technology. Each involved the settlement of an existing Section 2 dispute. It's unmistakable from the literature that the mandatory licensing promoted entry. Semiconductors, dramatic entry into the semiconductor business. Xerox, substantial entry into the plain paper copying business. In each instance, the remedy did accomplish entry. Who entered? Basically foreign firms. They were the main new participants in these industry segments. And the literature raises questions, especially in talking about IBM, AT&T, a series of articles that Laura Tyson has authored. The main question that rises is, what did it do to incentives to innovate? That is, what did the knowledge that mandatory licensing would be put in place, what did it do to the defendants' incentives to innovate and perhaps to others as well? And the literature also mentions that if you're going to do licensing, you have to decide what data. Do you have to send people along with the data to communicate the know-how? Exactly what specifically does the licensing requirement entail? Let me finish this segment simply by saying a word about conduct. The typical literature in the antitrust law and economics volumes describes conduct remedies as being failed and being relatively tepid. I think a lot of that literature takes this tone because, in part, perhaps the assumptions that they make about the cases themselves and about the impact of conduct-related remedies is perhaps questionable. In United Shoe Machinery, the prototypical case, the government was complaining when it went back to the Supreme Court for a divestiture order in the 60s that deconcentration had not proceeded fast enough. Well, United Shoe's market share at the time of the divestiture decree in the late 60s had fallen to 60%. And the government said, that's not good enough. We want it down in the 30s. Then we'll be happy. Today, looking at that, would we say a divestiture, a remedial decree that dropped the defendant's market share from the high 80s down to 60 is necessarily a failure, when indeed it allowed other firms to enter and begin operating? Is that a lack of success? The literature that regarded anything short of an atomized industry structure thought it was. I'm not so sure that that assumption is sound today. And the other concern is whether or not, in fact, the specific diagnosis of behavior in United Shoe was correct. And I simply mention here that there is a new literature that says a lot of what United Shoe was doing, such as the lease-only policy, may have been designed to serve legitimate quality control objectives, to provide a feedback mechanism that ensured that adjustments were made to the design of the machines. Some commentators, Scott Mastin and Ted Snyder, in one paper in particular, suggested this sent United Shoe down the road of less innovation, less superior performance, and ultimately put the company on the skids that led to exit. Let me finish my comments with a few comments about process. What about the speed of the process? Is antitrust well-suited to handling these problems? Technologically dynamic industries put tremendous pressure at the joints of the antitrust system because things do change quickly. And think in this instance about what happens even if the government runs the table and get a remedy. That's 30 months away, 20 months away at a minimum, maybe 30 months away. Maybe the government would get interim relief from Judge Jackson of some form. But the lasting substantial remedy may be well over the horizon. Does anyone here want to make a confident bet about what happens in this sector over the next 2 to 2.5 years? The second problem is the expertise. What do you do about the district judge who says, one person, no electoral mandate, no broad fact-finding powers, what do I do? Well, one suggestion that Congress considered in 1914 in creating the FTC Act, in Section 7 of the FTC Act, was that the FTC could act as a master in chancery to support dissolution proceedings by a district judge. The district judge could say, we want the FTC to help us work out the remedial plan. That's happened once, and not since the late teens. Why? Because the FTC, sad to say, alum that I am, never developed the level of expertise or the soundness of analysis to give a judge confidence that they would have a lot to offer. And another element of failure on the FTC's part, a rationale for its creation, was that the administrative process would provide innovative, fast-track methods for resolving cases. The FTC now expresses pride that it is creeping up on the record that federal district judges have achieved. Not that we're much better, but at some point we will be as good as the typical federal district judge. A disappointment in the performance of existing institutions. Let me finish by confessing some poverty in what we know about past remedies. One reason we know relatively little, and one reason that I think conclusions tend to be tentative here, is that we don't spend much effort going back and looking at what happened in the past cases. Only in a handful of instances have the federal agencies, as a conscious part of their own process, gone back and said, what happened when we did this before? What are the results? Again, to go back to Bert and my tenure at the FTC did this once in the late 1970s. It conducted evaluations of completed cases involving distribution practices and the Xerox case, the patent licensing case. Tim Bresnahan's conclusions in the patent licensing case are contested and debated, but it did provide an informative glimpse of what actually happened in the case. Well, why don't the agencies do this routinely? Well, because you can learn three things from an evaluation of your past cases. One is that you did a good job. The other two are bad. The second is we did nothing. Third is we hurt things. If you use Burt's probability calculation, 2 out of 3 are bad odds. And how do you do it in a way that actually generates the results? By way of a footnote, when we go overseas and advise transition economies about how to run their antitrust systems, a standard bit of advice is you ought to perform after the fact assessments. Indeed, the OECD routinely goes to the new emerging antitrust systems and periodically conducts audit panels where 3 experts will require the agency to bring forward their files and discuss their cases and be subject to criticism. It's a good idea for them. It's a good idea for us. And one reason that it's so hard to make confident conclusions about what should be done in the future is that we've invested so desperately little effort to know what has happened in the past. Thanks.
Thank you, Bill. We're going to take a 15-minute break and come back. We do have some flexibility for those who came in late. One of our speakers in the afternoon, Will Roger, won't be here. And so maybe we'll push with Mr. Burrill and other members of the Law Review's permission. We'll see how flexible we can be and give enough time to all of the speakers to have their say. Come back in 15 minutes. Thanks. Our next speaker is Professor Leonard Orlin. Do you want me to do this again? Okay. Thank you for that glowing introduction. I appreciate it.
He's obviously had memory loss from earlier this morning.
A couple of preliminary comments before I undertake the modest task of talking about teaching antitrust in the era of Microsoft. A few years ago, I wrote an article, I guess I like the concept, called Teaching Antitrust After Perestroika, in which I tried to talk about antitrust in the context of the disintegrating Soviet Union. I thought that there were 2 or 3 kind of central points made by previous speakers that I wanted to briefly comment on. One is the notion, which I think is very much true, that antitrust seems now to be an issue that the man and the woman on the street think about, however peripherally. Antitrust, once again, seems to matter. The social historian, brilliant social historian Richard Hofstadter, wrote an essay 25 years ago called Whatever Happened to the Antitrust Movement, talking about the fact that antitrust had kind of died as a political entity. I think it's back,
And I think, unlike Rick Rule, that antitrust is about much more than economic analysis. And I don't think that efficiency, while important, is at the core of antitrust. There's a debate that's been going on for a quarter of a century about the political component of antitrust. And I think that the question of whether of power and restraints of power is still, for me, very much part of antitrust. Second thing that I think it's important to note, which is kind of self-evident when I was listening to Rick Rule, is that forums are not places to resolve legal disputes. And there are fundamental issues of fact and fundamental issues of law that have been laid out in a courtroom. There are briefs, there are transcripts, and it's very hard for me or anyone else to say, Microsoft is a bad monopolist and should be punished. The answer is that without really informed access to the data and the transcript, judgments like that are very hard to make. The third point, which I think is important, that I thought had been so brilliantly and intelligently laid out by Bill, is that remedies very much are an afterthought in antitrust. And I think that's true, and I think one of the things that my talk on teaching, when I get to it, will be about, is about looking at remedies as the fulcrum for thinking about antitrust, rather than thinking about antitrust and then as an afterthought thinking about remedies. But for me, the paucity of thinking about remedies is part of a larger paucity of thought. I spend a lot of time and effort thinking about how the criminal law should be applied to large publicly held corporations. And the question of sanctions, meaningful sanctions, intelligent sanctions, to be imposed on an artificial entity is something that has been given relatively little intelligent thought other than saying fine them and corporations pass those fines off to stockholders ultimately. The final point about evaluation. We can ask, and we should ask, does antitrust accomplish anything? Did the divestitures of the past achieve anything? I learned a lot this morning about that. But it seems to me that's part of a larger question which can be asked. Does anything in law work? Accomplish what it's supposed to accomplish. We spend several $1 billion a year on the war on drugs. Does that accomplish anything? We spend more billions of dollars building prisons and doubling the prison population. Does that accomplish anything? We have extraordinary enforcement. Take an area like the SEC and insider trading and the whole host of things one could ask. What does that accomplish? And who can demonstrate in any empirically valid manner the positive benefits of legal decisions and legal rules? I'm not sure that, it depends who has the burden of proof, that you can demonstrate historically or prospectively or contemporaneously to anyone's satisfaction that anything works. So a lot of it are articles of faith.